my name is Taco. I want to say shout out to all the raccoons on campus. You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's sure smoky in Minnesota today.
Those aren't clouds. That's Canadian smoke.
That smoke rising from wildfires burning more than a million acres across several Canadian provinces, some for weeks now.
Have we already passed the point of no return for polar glaciers? Sea level rise redraws the map of the world. Explore with top glaciologist Dr. Chris Stokes from Durham University in the UK. But first, Canadian fire expert Michael Flanagan reports on the latest giant outbreaks in the north. Tens of thousands were evacuated. Unhealthy smoke is covering Canada, the U.S. Midwest, New York to Georgia, reaching Greece and Ireland. We are living in the climate future already.
Oh my God.
Fires raging in Saskatchewan forced more communities to evacuate over the weekend.
This morning, some of the nation's midsection tinted with a milky haze as wildfires burn out of control in Canada, smoke being blown across the border for days.
Tonight, airlifted to safety, the relief and frustration as more Canadians flee wildfires.
It's very hard and tiring and scary.
Stranded for days, their community cut off. Some evacuees escape to find hotels at capacity.
Canadian wildfires are back, starting early. The 2023 wildfire season in Canada burned an estimated 18.4 million hectares of land, over seven times the annual average. The majority of people in the Northwest Territories were evacuated. It was a gruesome year. Now the blazing nightmare is burning across northern Canada again. Unhealthy smoke already drifted down into the Midwest states, New York, and as far south as Georgia. Is this the new normal in the age of climate change? I think the best expert on Canadian wildfires is Dr. Michael Flanagan. After a distinguished career at the University of Alberta, Mike is now British Columbia Research Chair in Predictive Services, Emergency Management, and Fire Science at Thompson Rivers University. He is author or co-author on hundreds of peer-reviewed papers on forest fires. Mike Flanagan, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you, Alex.
Did the 2025 fire season start earlier than in 2023?
Actually, no. 2023 is exceptional, off the charts, record-smashing year. This year started early. It's very active, and only 2025 had more area burned at this point in time and had a faster start.
And you're in northern British Columbia, I believe. Are you already seeing fires there?
So I'm actually in south-central British Columbia, Kamloops, on the Thompson River. The northeast is on fire, and northern Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, northwestern Ontario. That's the corridor. About 2.2 million hectares has burned at this point, which is about the size of New Jersey.
Given your long career of fire watching, what do you find noteworthy about the Canadian wildfires so far?
Well, it started fairly normal. Once the snow goes, much of Canada sees snow during the winter. And until the vegetation flushes, the grass turns green and leaves come out, there's a window of opportunity for fire because you still have a lot of dead organic material. And most of the fires that time of year are human caused because our lightning season is just kicking into gear now. And, you know, about half of our fires are human caused, half are lightning caused, but human caused dominate in the spring. Lightning dominates in the summer. Then we had some heat and temperatures near 100 degrees Fahrenheit in southern Manitoba, and we had a rash of fires and, unfortunately, a couple fatalities, which is really unusual for civilian fatalities to happen in Canada. And then we had a real episode the last couple of weeks where it's been hot, dry, and windy, and then we got some lightning starts, and now we're on fire, and the smoke has gone to Florida, it's gone to the Mediterranean, and these fires will burn through the summer. These are huge fires, and unless we see torrential rains or Herculean efforts by fire management, these fires will burn all summer. And every time we get some wind, they'll grow and produce smoke, and who knows where it's going to end up. I can almost guarantee you it won't be another 2023, but it will be a very active fire season. We're already, you know, halfway to our normal annual area burned, and it's only early June. So expect this to continue. The seasonal forecast, which you do have to take with some salt, or perhaps a lot of salt, suggests it's going to be hot and dry over much of Canada. So we may see these fires continue, and perhaps fires in other areas that are currently not active.
And we know wildfires can create their own weather systems, including winds and even lightning. Any of that so far this year?
Actually, that's a good point, because this year we've seen more pyro CBs. These are fire-generated thunderstorms than I've seen in any other season to this point. So when you have combustion through a forest fire, it produces heat, obviously, but also a byproduct is moisture. And it's kind of like your grade 3 water cycle. You know, this plume rises, eventually it starts to cool, and then clouds can form, and then you can get a thunderstorm with lightning and hail and rain. But the lightning can start new fires, and this has happened on other pyro CBs, fire-generated thunderstorms. We're just seeing fires are more intense than they used to be. And this is a real challenge for fire management, because high-intensity fires like we see with these pyrocumulonimbus are difficult to impossible to extinguish, which means you have to get out of the way. Evacuations, and we've got over 30,000 people evacuated already, and that number is probably going to increase. The number of structures lost is over 400 in Saskatchewan alone. The other option fire management has is to do a burnout operation where you get in front of the wildfire, start a new fire. Yes, you're starting a fire, but it's fighting against the wind. It's backing into the wind, so it's lower intensity and manageable. Eventually, this burnout operation and the wildfire meet, and the wildfire has no more fuel or vegetation to burn, and it can be very effective. They use this tool a lot. As long as the winds aren't shifting, it's a good tool. But when those winds shift, that burnout operation could become another wildfire. Now you're a bigger problem than you were when you started.
Yes, there were about 30,000 people evacuated so far. They've already filled up the larger cities in Manitoba and Saskatchewan. People are being shipped off even to Ontario. And here again, we have a racial justice aspect of climate change, too, because the majority of people fleeing their homes are Aboriginal or First Nations people. The hotels have overflowed. Some people are sleeping in arenas waiting for help. I wonder, could the old way of life in the Canadian North be no longer possible in this age of superfires? What do you think, Mike?
So we live in a flammable landscape, for sure. And we're seeing more fire, and we're seeing more intense fire. The area burned in Canada has quadrupled since the 70s, similar to Western United States. You know, I think there is a way forward. There's a program called Fire Smart in Canada, a similar program in the United States called FireWise, and there's principles to help your community and your home be more resilient to fire. We can't make them fireproof, but we can do things to make them more resilient. So I think we can live if we use these fire smart principles, and if we use things like sprinklers can be very effective if fire does come. We can manage fuels around the community, but the challenge there is that the way a fire typically enters a community is through a rain of embers, little burning bits of twigs, bark, sometimes even pine cones. And the wind can carry them, or these pyro CBs can waft them in the air for kilometers, 2 kilometers, sometimes 5. I'm hearing stories from California and Australia, even longer distances. So even if you treat, you know, the vegetation, the forest right beside your community, a burning ember can come from miles or kilometers away, leapfrog over that right into town. And once fire gets in town and starts one structure burning, can burn structure to structure. And you can lose the whole town that way. And that's the challenge. And, you know, so people will continue to live, but yes, fires disproportionately impact indigenous communities, because there's many indigenous communities that are remote. Some have no road access, some have one road access. So that's a challenge for evacuation, and that challenge is going to continue. This is our new reality. You know, I don't like the term new normal, because it sounds like we're in a steady state or a plateau, and actually we're in a trajectory, you know, Dante's circle of hell. I'm not sure what circle we're on, a third or fourth, but I know the direction we're going. It's getting worse, and we'll continue on that, because we live in a warmer world, and a warmer world means more fire.
Let's talk about wildfire smoke. New research, and I see paper after paper on this, shows breathing smoke is more dangerous than we realized. It kills, it can shorten lives, it can worsen other medical conditions. And already smoke from Canadian fires has reached the United States and even into Europe, as you say. You track satellite images. Have you seen anything interesting?
Yeah, smoke can travel long distances, and that's part of the issue, is that if you live, you know, major metropolitan area, downtown New York, downtown Boston, your place isn't going to burn down because of wildland fire. But the quality of life can be in the tank for weeks. Also, recent research suggests that about 1.5 million people die every year globally due to wildfire smoke. That's an amazing number, and you know, that's really scary. And we're seeing more fire, and we're seeing more smoke in many areas around the world. And you're right, smoke affects IQ, fetus development. The more we know about smoke, the more we see how hazardous it is for human health. And, you know, we can do things to protect ourselves. You can buy air purifiers, air filters. You can wear a mask if it's particularly smoky, the N95 mask that we use for COVID. Were first developed for wildfire smoke. So they are very effective. But it is a problem, and it's only going to get worse.
According to the EU Copernicus satellite monitoring, smoke from the spring 2025 fires in Canada has already reached Europe, and the plume can be seen from Greece to Ireland. But they say there is little health risk at this time because the smoke is too high to breathe. It's just a haze and nice sunsets, I guess. Have you seen studies about intercontinental drift of wildfire smoke?
Just that it exists, and you're right. Typically, the smoke that reaches Europe and beyond is at higher levels of atmosphere, and so doesn't affect the air quality at the surface, unlike what we're seeing in Canada and the United States. Another aspect of smoke, is, especially with those pyrocumulonimbus, is it can be injected into the stratosphere. So fires in our weathers in the troposphere, but if things are intense, it can pump smoke into the stratosphere that can last for weeks, if not months, and just stay trapped up there. So, and that affects our climate in a couple of ways. And the impacts of smoke is an area of study. It's not exactly my area of study. So I want to limit my conversation on this topic.
Experts used to tell us, don't count forest fire carbon in climate, because any carbon will be recaptured when the forests regrow. And years ago, in an interview, you and I talked about regrowth. You told us very intense fires could sterilize the soil, and any place that reburns within 5 years might prevent that forest from coming back due to the whole seeding mechanism. Are you seeing any of those conditions in this year's fires, like reburns or extreme behavior, or is it too soon to tell?
For this year, it's too soon to tell, but we've had a number of bad fire years in the last decade. And colleagues of mine have been doing research on this topic, and they are finding areas that are not regenerating as rapidly or as well as they have in the past. So we are starting to see the impacts of increased fire frequency and intensity. Another aspect about fire is, on an upland forest, it's about carbon neutral over a long period of time. Because a fire comes through, you get new growth that absorbs carbon from the atmosphere, and then it burns again. And unless it's the state change from forest to grassland, which is a one-time credit or negative, you know, it's pretty well carbon neutral. However, peatlands, sphagnum mosses, many of these areas have been collecting carbon for thousands of years, so they're a carbon reservoir, legacy carbon, and a fire can eject that into the atmosphere in a matter of days or weeks and could be a significant source of greenhouse gases. The other role is we have a lot of permafrost in the boreal forest of Canada, Alaska, and Siberia, and when a fire goes through, it changes the albedo and accelerates the thawing of the permafrost, which has hydrates, methane, and as well as we continue to warm, the warmer temperatures are also thawing the permafrost, releasing methane, which, though measured in parts per billion in our atmosphere, are a very effective greenhouse gas, approximately 8 times more effective than carbon dioxide. It's playing a more significant role and is increasing much more rapidly than our carbon dioxide.
I do worry about those peat fires. I remember in 1997-98 when the big peat fires in Indonesia put that country up into one of the world's top polluters for that year and had some effects on the climate, we think. Now, even if regrowth recaptures some carbon, that does take years. Meanwhile, massive wildfires add gigatons more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, affecting all kinds of systems, maybe glacial melt or rainfall. Is the great boreal forest stretching around the world a net sink or source of carbon these days?
So, you know, that's an interesting question because, you know, some of your listeners may remember the Kyoto Protocol in Canada and Russia argued vigorously for Article 3.4, which would get credit for forest management because our forests, you know, the argument was that forests are absorbing carbon from the atmosphere. But after some analysis by the Canadian Forest Service, they decided that more likely than not, our forests are going to be carbon sources and not sinks. And that turned out to be true because of things like fire and insects. So most years, our forests in Canada are carbon sources and not carbon sinks anymore. As for Alaska and Siberia, I'm not sure if I have those numbers handy, but definitely in Canada, you know, our forests are no longer carbon sinks.
Scientists are talking about seeding the atmosphere with sulfur to reduce solar energy getting to the surface, but that may be small beans compared to the atmospheric changes from these fires. Can we control superfires in the north? Should we?
So there's a couple of things. So a fire in the north, if it threatens the community or critical infrastructure, yes, we should put it out. These fires that end up being huge, they all start as a spark, a lightning strike, a campfire. They all start small. And there is an opportunity to put those fires out while they're small. And sometimes in extreme conditions, that window is small. That's why detection of fires, reporting of those fires is so important. So a decision can be made. So decisions have to be made quickly to say, you know, is this an unwanted fire that we need to put out right away, or is this just Mother Nature doing her thing, and we'll just monitor the situation to make sure that, you know, no communities or critical infrastructure is threatened. So, you know, that's the challenge. But we will continue to see large, intense fires on our landscape. And whether we fight them or not, sometimes we'll be successful. I mean, overall, places in Canada, United States, you know, success rate ranges around 95% of the fires they fight are small. They put them out while they're small. But the 5% that escape or get large are responsible for almost all of the area burned. So the tail wags the dog in terms of the distribution of fire sizes. And typically these happen during extreme periods of hot, dry, windy weather. There's a recipe for wildfire. It's a simple recipe. You need 3 ingredients. Vegetation, we call it fuel. What type, how much, how dry. Ignition, people and lightning. It's about 50-50 in Canada. Not the same in the States. Much more, probably 90% plus are human caused. And hot, dry, windy, extreme weather. Those are the things that drive fire.
Canada has a new government now. If you were to meet up with the new Prime Minister, Mark Carney, what would you be advising when it comes to wildfires in this country?
So what I would be telling the Prime Minister is that we have to do more with how we deal with fire. And the situation is that currently fire management is the responsibility of landowners. And so there's 10 provinces, two of the three territories, and there's some federal agencies like Parks Canada. But we generally are reactive, okay? We're not proactive. You know, if we have a fire and we're overwhelmed, or fires in a region, and we call for help, it takes 3 days for that firefighter to get to the fire, and that's 3 days too late sometimes. Our weather forecasts are pretty decent for fire weather, 5-7 days, and when things look extreme and we have models of expecting new fires, we can move resources to those regions to address the unwanted fires. In Canada, we don't have a FEMA-type agency, a Federal Emergency Management Agency. So when we need extra help, we call for help from other provinces or territories or other countries, or we call in the Canadian Armed Forces, the military. But the military doesn't have very much training for fighting fires. They're great for evacuation, but for fighting fires, they're not. So we need a quick deploy, proactive firefighting agency, national, that can move to those locations ahead of time to deal with these surges. You know, there's episodes where we get overwhelmed, but if we move resources ahead of time, crews, helicopters, etc., I think we can reduce the disasters. The cost of disasters is increasing. We're seeing more of them. We had Jasper burn last year, of course, LA fires this year. Fort McMurray in 2016 was the costliest disaster in Canadian history. If we prevent one of those, it more than pays for itself.
It must be a bit strange. I mean, many of the scientists I talk to, their subject areas are disappearing, whether it's insects in the trees or even glaciers. But your field that you've been working in, as far as I know, most of your life, it's increasing, and that's not good. What are your feelings about that?
So the reason we're seeing more attention on fire is because of the impacts. You know, like I can give you number of fires, area burn statistics, but at the end of the day, it's really about the impacts. And we're seeing, multiple billion-dollar impacts from fires in California, Maui fire, Camp Fire in California, recent Jasper fire in Canada. We're just seeing more and more of these disasters, and it's going to increase. So we're seeing more attention in terms of research, in terms of management, and in terms of the media. Fire, has great pictures, but it's impacting us. And whether, the impact can be direct, your town can burn down from the fire, or from smoke that can travel thousands of miles or kilometers. Or, in the West, we have what's called cascading impacts, where you have a fire in mountainous terrains, and then you get those winter rains, and you get debris flows, flooding. And so these impacts have been increasing significantly. I mentioned that area burn in Canada has quadrupled since the 1970s, same with the Western United States. And we see catastrophic fires in Australia, Chile, Greece. It's just going on and on, and that's why we're seeing so much more attention on fire.
Mike Flanagan was editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Wildland Fire. He's taken on leadership roles with the U.S. National Assessment on Global Change and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's pretty well known in print, TV, and radio as a go-to expert on wildfires. Michael Flanagan, thank you for spending time again with our listeners.
My pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Three quick things. Last week, the Canadian fire clouds met a 2,000-mile-wide front of Saharan dust with dry air that was covering Cuba, the Caribbean, and most of Florida. Dust plus fire smoke is not good. Two, decades of cleaning up smog for better health is being undone by toxic wildfire smoke in the new fire era. Think about it. You don't have to be in Canada to be part of the Canadian wildfires. Big fires in places no one has ever heard of are becoming a global threat. And finally, as our guest Chris Stokes told me after our upcoming interview, fire ash lands on glaciers, further reducing the reflectivity of Earth. The sun's energy stays on the surface instead of bouncing back towards space. The darker color speeds up glacier melt. This is another way global warming reinforces itself. Heat equals more fires, equals more smoke, equals darkening ice, equals more warming, equals more heat. As polar regions continue to warm, the remaining ice goes gray with ash. Greenland scientist Jason Box has published pictures of that gray landscape instead of the pristine white snow and ice it used to be.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Sea level rise will cause catastrophic inland migration. Even 1.5 degrees C of warming is not safe for glaciers. The new science comes from a team led by Professor Chris Stokes of Durham University in the UK. Dr. Stokes is a glaciologist, publishing for the past 25 years on world glaciers in the distant past and for future warming. He has over 200 research works and many book chapters. From Durham, Chris Stokes, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
How important is sea level rise to the future of humanity and other species?
I often phrase this as an existential threat. You know, this is literally something that will threaten the existence of species and human populations. If you just think about it, about 230 million people live within 1 meter of sea level. Many of our big cities around the world are within a few meters of sea level. Around a billion people live within 10 meters of sea level. So whilst it's increasing at a relatively slow rate at the moment, and you know, for some that will be imperceptible, it really is this, as I said, this existential threat to humanity. And I'm sure we'll come round to it. But how we respond to that is something that is going to be a major challenge for society, for governments, policymakers to negotiate over the coming years.
According to your new paper, the rate of sea level rise per year is accelerating. In fact, the sea is rising three times faster now than during the 1900s. Chris, is this mainly from expansion of the ocean as water heats up, or is it from melting ice?
Well, that's a very good question, because our ability to measure the different kind of what we call components of sea level rise has really improved over the last few decades. Our measurements have become very accurate. Our estimates of what's causing the sea level rise has become more and more accurate. And you're right that in the past, it's been the thermal expansion of the ocean water that has been the dominant contributor. So that's just the fact that, you know, the density of the ocean changes as it warms and heats up and it expands, and that causes sea level rise. But what we now know is that the contribution from melting glaciers and the polar ice caps, or ice sheets as we call them, has now started to dominate. So now for the, you know, the last few years has seen that what we call the cryosphere contribution from glaciers and ice sheets, that has now overtaken thermal expansion. And in the paper that we've recently published, we showed that actually the contribution from the polar ice caps or ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica has now become the dominant contributor from the cryosphere. So over the last century, it was those small mountain glaciers dotted around the world that melted most rapidly and contributed to sea level rise. But now we're starting to see some very dramatic changes in the polar ice sheets in Greenland and in Antarctica. And that's what's really worrying, and that was the focus of our paper.
And the rate of sea level rise may be as important as the total amount. Why?
Yes, that's a really good point, and one I'd want to stress as well. We often talk about, you know, future projections will say that sea level rise might be 2, 3, 4 meters, but the timescales are vitally important, because, you know, if you're going to say that, I don't know, a city, say London, has to adapt to 2 meters of sea level rise, well, if it's got 500 years to do that, then obviously it's going to be easier than if it's got just 100 years or 50 years to do that. So what we do in the paper, and what a lot of scientists would prefer to talk